During the German Revolution of 1919, a workers' deputy at the mushrooming councils in revolutionary Germany justified the Soviets in the following way. He said, "The Soviets are the modern form of revolution." And indeed, yes, in the 19th century, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, we will see the development in different shapes, different forms, different scopes of Soviet-like organs. We see the development of those organs in all countries and all continents. Marx already, basing himself on the experience of the 1848 revolution in France, launched the idea of workers' committees. The Paris Commune of 1871 was already an anticipation of later developments. We'll be in the general strike of 1905 in Russia, where we see for the first time a fully developed Soviet. Will be those Soviets, those councils of workers and soldiers and peasant representatives who will take power in October 1917 in Russia. And in all the subsequent revolutions in Germany, Austria, Hungary, Italy, we'll see the development of Soviets as the embryo of workers' power. Soviets, the Russian word for council, will become the general form in which workers' power will be organized. Actually, as soon as a strike becomes regional, national, and especially general, we will see the development of germs of workers' power. Those germs of workers' power develop as a result of the objective dynamic. It is in this turbulent period in Russia that workers start to elect representatives to factory committees or strike committees. Because yes, at its inception, Soviet is an enlarged strike committee. The Soviet is, first of all, an organ of struggle of the workers against the bosses. Soviets in 1905 will develop to full maturity as representative, flexible, and very effective organizations of the workers. I think it's very important to note that Soviets, the idea of Soviets, the proposal of Soviets, do not arise out of the mind of Lenin and Trotsky. They even do not appear in the writings of Marx and Engels. Actually, Soviets were not even anticipated in the Communist Manifesto. The Soviets were not anticipated in the Communist Manifesto. They are the result of the initiative of the masses. Without the intervention of any organized force, party or trade union. And nevertheless, they will play a central role in the 1905 revolution. What are the characteristics of the Soviets as they appear in Russia in 1905? First of all, they represent the broad layers of the workers. So not only the advanced workers, but also the backwards. They represent the party members and the non-party members. The Soviets regroup religious people and atheist people. They bring together literate and illiterate, skilled and unskilled workers. They organize blue-collar workers and white-collar workers. I repeat, they organize blue-collar workers and white-collar workers. So the Soviet embraces the whole of the working class in all its facets and contradictions. Actually, the Soviet, in 1905, especially in Petrograd, centralizes all the delegates from the strike committees of elected representatives. All of them are revocable. In the case of the Soviet of Petrograd, also representatives of parties and trade unions participate. Although they're a very tiny minority as representatives in the Soviet, as a centralized body of strike committees, the Soviet of Petrograd slowly, as a result of the dynamic of the general strike and the latter insurrection, will start to have more and more power. Actually, they will take more power to the extent that the power of the state, the bourgeois state, declines. And because that the Soviet broadens its scope within the general strike, you'll have more and more power. And the strike committees, who at the beginning were mainly, you know, fighting for economic demands, will have a much more political program. Very important is that the strike, the Soviets, will take decisions and will be able to put those decisions into practice. For instance, the Soviet of Petrograd was asking for freedom of the press and did not wait for the Tsarist autocracy to give them the freedom of the press. But the Soviet of Petrograd imposed the freedom of the press by seizing all the printing presses of the city. Also, the Soviet of Petrograd decreed 8-hour day and put it into practice. How was such a thing possible? Mainly because the Soviet gave itself the means of coercion. Se dau las medidas de coerción. What are those means of coercion? Especially the establishment of workers' militias, who could put into practice all the decisions the Soviet of Petrograd was taking. And indeed, a Soviet without workers' militias, call it Red Guards, call it Red Police, call it anything you want, but a Soviet without fighting detachments is nothing. A Soviet without the means of putting into practice its own decisions would be like a paper tiger. Within the Soviet of Petrograd, the political composition was mainly social democratic, but you also had representatives of petit bourgeois tendencies like the social revolutionaries. But most importantly, thanks to the system of regular elections and re-elections of the representatives of the workers to the Soviet, the political composition of the Soviet started to change. Thanks to this very democratic system, actually, the composition of the Soviet could follow the change in the political consciousness of it. And we know that especially in a revolutionary period or in any strike, the consciousness of the workers changes very rapidly. So those changes were very rapidly, almost immediately, reflected in the composition, in the attitudes of the representatives in the Soviet. Lenin, at that time, was in exile. But through his understanding of what was happening, he immediately greeted the formation of the Soviets. He even went further in brilliant anticipation. He said, look, those Soviets must become the future provisional revolutionary government. Lenin immediately understood the existence of the Soviets as the embryos of workers' power. This was Lenin's position. Attitude of the Bolsheviks in Petrograd was very, very different. Yes, during the revolution, the Bolsheviks were growing in influence, especially amongst the advanced workers. But because of one of the main characteristics of a revolution is that it puts into motion also the most backward layers of the workers, one of the key questions for a revolutionary vanguard is to understand how to link with the more backward layers of the workers. And in order to be able to answer that question, how do the vanguard relate to the more backward layers, the attitude towards the Soviet was a central question. Actually, the Bolshevik leaders in Petrograd had no feel for the real mass movement. No feel. No feel. Actually, the Central Committee of the Bolsheviks in Petrograd were very uneasy about this new phenomenon of Soviets. Even were, hostile to the Soviets, and really acted towards the Soviets as if it was a rival to the Social Democratic Party Russia, as if it was a rival. Instead of seeing the Soviets as a field of action, as a field of intervention. Even went so far of organizing a campaign against the Soviet of Petrograd. The method behind the reasoning of the leaders of the Bolsheviks in Petrograd was very sectarian formalistic. It makes me think of the attitude of the Greek Communist Party towards the Popular Assembly movement. The Bolshevik leaders in Petrograd launched ultimatums to the Soviets, especially ultimatums from outside, saying, you must do this, you must do that. The first demand of Bolshevik leaders in St. Petersburg was to say to the Soviets, the Soviet must place itself under the leadership of social democracy. Then They said, well, the Soviet of St. Petersburg must accept the program of social democracy. But they say, if you accept the program of social democracy, there's no need for the existence of two political organizations with the same program. So the Bolshevik leaders said, well, in that case, actually the Soviet should dissolve itself. Actually, the Bolsheviks at the time justified their hostility towards the Soviets in the following way. They said that spontaneity, in which they meant the Soviet, should be subordinated to consciousness. It was a very big mistake, the Bolsheviks made at the time. A mistake which played in the hands of the reformists, the Mensheviks, who, yes, participated in the Soviets, entered and agitated for it, but the reformists did not give a revolutionary content to the Soviets. They considered the Soviet as something like a labor congress, or something like the British Labour Party in a Russian version. So they had a completely reformist approach to the Soviets. Lenin was extremely frustrated by the attitude of his comrades in St. Petersburg. Interesting thing is that he probably was the only one among the Bolsheviks who understood the real meaning of the Soviets and had a real feel with the masses. At a certain moment, the paper of the Bolsheviks in St. Petersburg carried an article with the title Party or Soviet. And Lenin said this is very wrong. Actually, it is Party and Soviet. And he said we should win, you know, a majority within the Soviets, not based on ultimatums, but on patient work within the Soviets. This important lesson in methods, you know, will be decisive in transforming the insurrection of 1917 to a successful taking of power by the workers in Russia. The Soviets, in a fully developed form, as organs of power, had to replace the existing state apparatus. In the sense that they, in the assembly of the Soviets, they fuse together the legislative power, the executive power, and the juridical power. In that sense, they realize actually the ideals and the practice of the Paris Commune of 1871. But Lenin in 1917, like never in his life, was no fetishist of one organizational form. See, what is important is not the form, but the content. And especially the political and the class content of the actions of the Soviets. Like Alan explained earlier in his lead-off on the Russian Revolution, at a certain moment, Lenin and the Bolsheviks were a bit desperate about the political evolution of the Soviets in 1917. Because most of us would, you know, naturally identify Soviets with revolution. But you also have reformist Soviets, you have also conservative Soviets, and you can also have counter-revolutionary and bourgeois Soviets. And Lenin, at a certain moment in 1917, despaired by the political evolution of the Soviets dominated by the Mensheviks, even suggested that we should call not for all power to the Soviets, but all power to the factory councils. The factory councils were much more revolutionary even than the Soviet at the time. Also, Lenin suggested that, for instance, the British Labour Party or the trades councils established in Britain could become the instrument through which the workers in Britain could take power. Just to say, you know, we don't have to make a fetish of one organizational form. And also, I think the rich history of the revolutionary movement after 1917, we'll see different forms, you know, and shapes in which workers' power will appear. And yes, in Germany, during the revolution of 1919, we see the mushrooming of councils. It is the end of the war, the military and state apparatus in Germany is collapsing, and following the example of Russia, almost 10,000 councils or German Soviets are formed all over the country. Interesting is that from the beginning, actually, the councils in Germany are dominated by the reformists. The way the councils are elected, we also have an important influence on their political attitude and the actions they take. Some of the councils in Germany are elected by applause, by acclamation. Some of the councils, contrary to the Russian-Soviet experience, some of the German councils contrary to the Russian experience, were elected based on the workplace, are elected on the territorial base. Especially the reformists insist on having no elections of councils based on the productive units, but on the neighborhoods, neighbor del barrio, instead of the unit of production. Social Democrats say, well, this gives a more universal character to their councils. Actually, what you see is those councils, the German Revolution, who are elected on a territorial base, so-called more universal character, are dominated from the beginning by the apparatuses of the union bureaucracies and the social democrats. Those councils tend to be dominated by the petit bourgeois elements and politically are often the most conservative councils. Contrary, where the election of the councils happen on a base of the factory, on the unit of production, is often the more left-wing social democrats or the Spartacists or the independents who are elected at the council. But most of the councils in Germany are indeed elected on the base of the unit of production, the factory, the workplace. Some of those councils start to abolish the local state institutions and replace them. Some also correctly develop their own police force. And you see something similar in Germany developing as in Russia in 1905 or 1917 is the existence of a second power in society. Actually, in Germany at that time, 1919, no one is capable of opposing the existence or the actions of the councils. Even the general staff of the German army recognizes officially the existence of the councils of soldiers' deputies. In a clever move, the general staff, the German army, asks for a meeting with the soldiers' deputies. And they ask them to collaborate with the general staff in organizing the evacuation of the German soldiers out of the occupying world countries. All the administrations at local, regional or national level, the judges, the imperial authorities, they all recognize, pretend to recognize the councils. The social democrats, the reformists, you know, in Germany, also recognize and participate actively in the difficulties. But they consider the council something temporary, transitional. Not temporary or transitional towards the establishment of workers' power, but temporary, transitional to the re-establishment of bourgeois states. So in Germany, at a mass scale of one of the most decisive capitalist countries in the world at that time, we see the development of a situation that Marx has called a situation of dual power. This is a situation where a second power is emerging, you know, parallel to the existing bourgeois state institutions. Dual power also means dual impotence, in the sense that one power, the diminishing force of the bourgeois state, is not capable anymore to rule and to exert its authority as before. And another power, working class power, is starting to exert its authority over all aspects of life, but is not ready yet, or not conscious yet, how to take power. For instance, the Berlin Council, which is the most central council, the most decisive council from a political point of view in the revolution in Germany, Berlin. Because of the absence of a party, you know, which can win the majority within the Berlin Council for the program of workers' power, is permanently wavering on what to do, hesitating on what to do. At a certain moment, the Berlin Council of Workers and Soldier Deputies is so overwhelmed by petty tasks, day-to-day problems, that one of the workers' deputies criticizes it of having become just a department of the Ministry of Labor. Actually, the German councils were not conscious enough of the tasks to establish the councils as, you know, the new and unique source of power in Germany. The social democratic majority, on the other hand, will be the instrument of the restoration of the bourgeois institutions and the bourgeois state. It's interesting to see how the social democratic majority attack the councils, how they undermine the councils at the time. Social democrats say, oh yes, we're in favor of councils, but they only represent a minority of the population in Germany. We need not election of deputies just based on the unit of production, but we need, you know, universal suffrage. Everybody should be able to vote. The Social Democrats say, yes, the victory of German militarism was a victory of all of the people, not just of industrial workers. In that sense, they were exploiting the democratic illusions of the mass of the workers, or the majority of the workers, who still believed in some kind of, you know, parliamentarism. And the Social Democrats, majority of the reformists, opposed, actually, the councils to the existence and the election of a constituent assembly in Germany. In Germany, just like in Russia, the agitation for a constituent assembly, you know, in an autocracy or under German militarism, was a very important demand. Yes, that the agitation for a constituent assembly in Germany, just like in Russia, was an important and a correct demand, especially to attract and to convince the more backward layers of workers and peasants. And yes, in Germany, the workers in general, of course, and broader population were sympathetic towards the councils, but their democratic aspirations were also channeled to the demand of the election of a constituent assembly. Lenin in Russia combined the demand for a constituent assembly with agitation for Soviets. But the young, you know, group of Spartacists around Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht were quite ultra-left in regards to those democratic aspirations. Actually, Spartacists did not really know how to work within those councils. They had not digested the lessons, you know, of the Russian Revolution. They had not understood the methods of Lenin. For instance, in an important city in Germany called Dresden, when the Spartacists, you know, the future communists of Germany, were placed in a minority, they decided to split for the Soviets. And those ultra-left attitudes, actually, of the Spartacists, they played into the hands of the Social Democrats. And the Social Democrats were able to maneuver, you know, the councils out of existence, in reality. The Social Democrats, the reformists, were able to maneuver the councils out of their own existence. At a certain moment, they almost dissolved or liquidated themselves. And instead of understanding that the masses had to go through experience also of their democratic illusions, the Spartacists boycotted the election for the Constituent Assembly. There were 83% of the population participated in the elections for the Constituent Assembly. So this shows the extent of the democratic illusions channeled through the parliament. Lenin, in his book on left-wing communism, criticizes strongly, you know, those ultra-left deviations. He says you have something indeed like parliamentary cretinismo parlamentario, but you also have something like anti-parliamentary cretinism. And the workers needed to go through that experience. Kautsky, at that time, tried to combine, you know, revolution and counter-revolution. In one of his books, which was also sharply criticized by Lenin, Kautsky said, well, actually, bourgeois parliament can exist side by side with workers' councils. I repeat, Kautsky said that a bourgeois parliament can coexist with workers' councils. He said, the workers' council can become something like a second chamber, something like a workers' senate. A workers' senate. Something like, instead of a house of lords, a house of workers. But of course, there is no middle way possible between revolution and counter-revolution. There's no middle way possible between bourgeois power and workers' power. And like I said earlier, the situation of dual power is by definition a very unstable and temporary situation. After a while, after a fierce struggle, then one or the other must win. A situation of dual power cannot exist indefinitely. And if the workers' councils who develop in a revolutionary situation are not conscious enough of what to do exactly, they will be maneuvered out by a combination of political maneuvering and repression. I don't know if you remember, but just a recent example of this was the uprising in Ecuador a few years ago. where the workers and the peasants surrounded the main cities, surrounded the state institutions, surrounded and took over parliament. They had effective power. The leader of the general staff of the army, after consultation with the US embassy, he goes to the leaders of the insurrection and he says, look, I'm on your side, I will take power. And naively, politically naively, but criminally, those leaders believe him. And when that general, who's the head of the general staff of the Ecuadorian army, formally becomes the leader of the revolution, the first thing he do is liquidate the revolution. But then it's important to draw all the lessons from the German revolution, from the Russian revolution, from the development of those councils, which through history will take different forms, different names also. You know, in some countries, in Spain, they called juntas or consejos obreros in the 30s. In the Iranian revolution, they were called shoras. Other places, they're called asambleas populares. They can take different forms and different names, but they contain in them the germs where to develop, where to grow, where to come to maturity of workers' power. In the beginning, they can develop, you know, not as revolutionary organs, not as organs who immediately want to take power. They can develop as organs of economic struggle, or more importantly, organs of workers' control. Like in Italy, for instance, in the post-war periods after the First World War, the left-wing socialists around Gramsci, who would later become the backbone of the Communist Party of Italy, in Torino, agitated and organized for the establishment of factory councils, combining different tasks of workers' control, of defense of economic interests, but also preparation for power. Interesting is again how left-wing people, so-called Marxists, did not understand the real meaning of and the real potential of the factory councils. Bordiga, who would later become the general secretary of the Italian Communist Party, Bordiga, even, you know, criticized the councils and didn't agree with them. They said, oh, this is just economism. There's a corporatist reaction of the workers. And of course, the social democrats, the right-wing socialists in Italy, consider them just as anarchist institutions. I think one common mistake in relation to the Soviets is that to state that Soviets can only exist for the needs of armed insurrection or immediate power. Actually, the Stalinists in the 30s posed the question of Soviets in those terms. Soviets can only exist in a situation of semi-insurrection, of on the verge of insurrection. Actually, Soviets arise long before the insurrection, arise long before the revolution. Actually, Soviets are, first of all, in the beginning, very often tools for economic and political struggle. So it is very often only Marxists who understand the full potential of Soviets when they appear. I think also those Soviets are very important for us because they are the arena, the terrain where Marxists must struggle for political influence. It must be the arena where Marxists, you know, struggle to win the majority for the ideas of revolution. They do this based on the common experience, on debate, on common struggle, in which the Marxists are ready, you know, to say to the workers, look, you can test our ideas. Here are our ideas. You don't agree with it? For the moment, it's okay. We stay with you, even if you don't agree with us. More importantly, the role of the Marxist is to give a class content to existing Soviets. Even in the beginning, the class content is not so clear. Our role is to have the workers to be represented at those Soviets in an organized form. For instance, in Greece, where the comrades directly agitate for the establishment of popular assemblies, to generalize popular assemblies, to centralize popular assemblies. You know, they also combine it with the demand of organizing strike committees for organizing the general strike, based, of course, on the unit of production, the factory, the workplace, so that the workers' voice, the workers', the class content, can be more apparent also in the popular assemblies. Or in the same way as the Tomres in Venezuela, where the revolution has launched, you know, the ideas of communal councils based on the neighborhoods, which of course we support, but we add that those communal councils are not enough and cannot exist, you know, parallel with the existing bourgeois and bureaucratic state institutions, but that the communal councils must replace them, and that we also agitate and work for the establishment of workers in our committees, in the factories. They link together, centralize, and also give a much more stabilizing content and a more class content to the popular assemblies, who are mainly based on the very, you know, shaky grounds of the neighborhoods of Venezuela. Están basados, también los consejos comunales, en las fundaciones bien inseguras de los barrios populares, la composición popular del barrio. Another common mistake in relation to the Soviets, again a distortion introduced by the Stalinists in the 30s, in a sense that the Stalinists oppose the formation of Soviets to the struggle for democratic demands. We think, together with Trotsky and Lenin, that Soviets can become a very important tool in the struggle for democratic demands. And in its development, Soviets, like organs, will come into conflict with existing bourgeois institutions. So I think this is very important. So not to oppose, you know, the agitation for Soviets as organs of workers' power to the needs of the real struggle at the moment. For instance, our comrades in Morocco, while at the same time calling for the constituent assembly, a revolutionary constituent assembly in Morocco, also agitate and take initiative sometimes for the establishment of popular assemblies in cities, towns, neighborhoods, with elected representatives for the neighborhoods, schools, universities, factories, whose first aim is to unify the struggle for democratic demands, in which they enlarge the program of democratic demands also to the social and economic demands of exploited masses in Morocco. And in the sense that, or to the extent more precise, that those popular assemblies develop, you know, win in scope, that strikes develop, those popular assemblies can become, you know, future organs of workers' power. And those organs can become and must become actually the future, you know, institutions of a workers' democracy. And it can only be done by replacing the existing state institutions with Soviet-like organs. But for many people, the word Soviet sounds a bit strange. It's like Russia thing. And it's also, you know, stained with bureaucracy and Stalinist totalitarian states. And I think that it's our task as International Marxist Tendency to reestablish actually the truth about what the Soviets really were. We reject, of course, the concept of the Stalinists who see Soviets just as a tool of a one-party dictatorship. Within the Soviets, all parties who accept, you know, the legitimacy of the Soviets, you know, must and can act in all freedom. That's the answer Trotsky gives to the question of democracy under the Soviets. When he is asked, you know, which party will you authorize in a Soviet workers' democracy, he says very clearly, all the parties who accept the Soviet system, with the exception, of course, of the fascists and all those who take, you know, armed or violent initiatives against workers' democracy. And within the Soviet system, you know, a Marxist party must struggle permanently to convince, to win over, not once, but twice, 10 times, 100 times, you know, the masses, the representatives of the masses. So the Soviets do not replace the vital importance of a Marxist party or Marxist tendency. When a general strike develops, when a revolution develops, the question of power is posed, of course. But who will give the answer to the question is a very decisive thing. Because in our absence, or if you are a tiny minority, there will be very different answers given to the same question. And this is where our role is, to give, on the basis of the historical experience of Soviets, to indicate in a very practical way what the mistakes were in the past and what measures should be taken. Also, the question will arise how to struggle against bureaucratism. Just do not imagine that bureaucratism within Soviets Workers' Council only appear after taking power. Bureaucratic tendencies already exist, you know, very soon in developing Soviets. They have to be fought from the beginning with a concrete and very clear program, which is fundamentally the program of the Paris Commune and of the French Revolution, in the sense that no representative in a council should have any material privileges. But all those people, you know, were elected, can be revocable at any moment. That there will be a rotation also in the functions, you know, of the future, you know, state functionaries. And of course, there should be no permanent army. I think those discussions are very important, especially in Europe in the last months. Because the movement in Spain for real democracy is a questioning, quite fundamental questioning, of bourgeois democratic institutions, bourgeois democracy. And people who participate in it are not naive. They lost their political virginity. And you know from experience, if you discuss with those youth and workers who participate in that movement, they will ask you very tough questions. So the world history of the working class, you know, in its successive revolutions, victorious revolutions and defeated revolutions, is very rich, you know, in experiences, in lessons. Our role is to transform those popular assemblies in Greece, those popular assemblies in Spain, those shoras in Iran in 79, or the consejos comunales in Venezuela, to transform them really in organs of workers' power. Not, I insist, not via ultimatums, not with the forceps, not through manipulation, not through maneuvering. We have seen a lot, you know, left-wing people who say, well, the workers don't really understand that. Well, let's try to have a deal before the meeting, before the assembly. No, we present our ideas, you know, for workers' power immediately, straightly to the workers. We have no blankest, you know, conspirational concept of taking power. I mean, we are the party. We are the international of the Soviets. We are those parties, you know, we are the organizations, those tendencies who represent and fight for the most advanced form of democracy which existed in humankind. This is our banner, comrades, the banner of workers' democracy, openly against Stalinist bureaucracy, against capitalist dictatorship of the banks and the markets. I think if we, you know, understand this after this and bring this to the many fields of intervention of our organization worldwide, and if we do that, if we absorb those lessons, we will be able to advance very strongly in the next months and years in the world. Thanks.